Hello and welcome to another video. I have with me friend of the channel, Scrump. How are you doing, Scrump?
Hello everyone. Apologies if my camera's slightly blown out. I've had to frantically reinstall the drivers on the way here, so the fact you can see me is a miracle. And as I had to explain to AA, yes, cameras do have drivers. but it should be fine. Hello, I've not been here for a little bit, and when I am here, people seem to be either very happy or very upset, so we'll see which way it goes.
Well, today we're talking about, not the dry topic, I'm afraid, but we're talking about a topic of some import, which is, well, if you're in Britain, that is. I don't know if anybody in any other countries care, but if you're in this country, the state of the British defence industry / Ministry of Defence / military services, military, navy, you name it. It's all, it's been in the news recently because, correct me if I'm wrong, because you've caught me at an interesting moment, Scrump, where I'm hoping to transcend politics. This is the last week I want to even cover politics on this channel in any great detail. I'm going to go back to my educational mode to try to get out of the slop swamp. So the right
The thing is, this actually doesn't have very much to do with politics at all. In fact, this is not a result of what we consider politics in terms of the party politics sense. The time horizons for the defense industry are actually they're very revealing because they show that all of this stuff, all of the management of Britain's things like defense systems, exist completely outside of the political purview. They exist whether or not Labour's in, they exist whether the Tories are in, and all countries must have armies, there must be some kind of defence, and it's not something we like to think about in Britain. We like to think we've moved past all of that, don't we? You know, there's some stuff in here where they talk about, well, it's because Britain's an island and we're surrounded by friendly countries, and, you know, they're trying to paint this... Don't panic, guys, you know, don't worry too much. But it really is it's a technical and management problem more than it is a political problem. And I think the fact that it's treated like a political... All the people who say, oh, politicising this isn't going to help, are probably right, but they're right for the wrong reasons. It's one of those things there isn't really much political solution to. And as you'll see, actually what happens is when politics intrudes into defence, when it tries to find a solution, it can't. It blunders around like a big baby, so...
Well, I mean, the reason it's been, correct me if I'm wrong, Scrump, the reason that everybody's focused on defence at the moment is because there's been disruption in the British government, which is that John Healey resigned. Is that right?
Yes. John Healey sounds like someone who'd resign in the 70s, though, doesn't he?
I had to double-check. Yeah, he's a very, like, a lot of these Labour people are, like, really 1970s-style figures. But this is, like...
Because descended from them. Like Kinnock's sons. He's the guy who was banging the immigration drum first, was Neil Kinnock's son.
But my understanding is that this is, I mean, politically, it's been yet another cycle of how can Starmer survive? And then obviously Starmer just, you know, robot-like, I am not going to go anywhere. I am not resigning. Doesn't matter how many people resign, I'm staying put. And also social media is banned for teenagers now. So suck on that. But what is the ostensible reason for this defense minister going? And then maybe we can use that as a lens to get into some of these deeper structural problems that you want to talk about.
Well, you've got the front end of the political shop window here, which is John Healey, the Armed Forces Minister, resigning. And also you have the defence minister designing as well. You've got the arms force minister and you've got everybody basically, all the military people who are supposed to interface between the government and the military have gone, I'm not tackling this. This isn't my problem. And to a degree, it really, really isn't their problem. It's a very long-running thing. But you're right, we'll have to zoom backwards on this. But it becomes quite ridiculous. You have these resignations that happen, like I said, most of all, the defence secretary, John Healey. I don't think anyone knows who Al Carnes is. Maybe if you're, again, I don't think people know who John Healey is, though. These are, unless you're a real, I didn't even really know that was the defense minister. I could look it up, but it's not something that sticks in your head, is he? I have to keep that's been the problem. The problem trying to research all of this for normal people and trying to get into the politics is that these people are so interchangeable and it feels so ridiculous. Oh, it's John Healy. This, I thought the defense minister was that blind guy. because that's the last time people checked in the defense minister. It was what's his face with his dog, Blunkett, you know? Blunkett can't see him, but he sure can bomb him. but it's John Healy, who's not as memorable a character as David Blunkett. But he's resigned because of the... it's the failure to implement the defense investment plan, which is from the Public Accounts Committee, which is part of the MO. So it's the dip from the PAC, which is really from the MOD. And this all stems from the Strategic Defense Review, the SD. It really is designed to be incredibly impenetrable. But the upshot is that there's been a report that triggered a spending review that was meant to come out in autumn but hasn't. And uh-oh, the homework hasn't been handed in and everyone's resigned. And it's not, the thing is, it's not boring. It is very, it's extremely thick of it. And Prime Minister, the defence investment plan is late. But I'm supposed to be announcing the defence plans, because that's been the problem. He's got, like, Zelensky over the number 10. And in the background, they actually don't have a defence plan yet. The committee that's supposed to plan it is more than 9 months late at this point. Which even in politics is quite a long time.
I mean, my understanding of all of this, John, if I may, is,
yes.
I mean, to try to cut a long story short, I feel like the British government has been given orders by the powers that be, namely Washington, America, you know, our special friends over there in the Middle East, Tony, right? I feel like they've basically given the British government orders. Listen, slash welfare, increase defence spending. Ultimately, we're going to need it up to 10% eventually, right? And the reason I say that is because when I was listening to LBC all the time, various government bods kept on coming on and saying, we need defence spending up to 10%. And they kept on saying it. And whenever a message is repeated on mainstream media, I'm saying, well, why is this is being repeated? Because they want us to know that good defense spending needs to be up to 10%. So this is obviously coming from somewhere. And given that, you know, America has basically given its NATO allies a direct order to increase defense spending, I'm guessing it's coming from there. Also, the figures who've resigned, again, are on that side of the party, they're towards the, you know, towards the Blairites, towards the power center. And I get the impression, to the extent that it even matters, right, what these individual players do, I get the impression that Sir Keir has gone a tiny bit kind of rogue. He's kind of like, ever since he got rid of Morgan McSweeney, I get the impression that this government is kind of like freewheeling. It's going to be like, oh, we're not actually going to reduce the welfare. So, yeah, that's happened. That military plan we said we're going to do, we're going to go back on that as well. The social media ban we said we wouldn't do. Do you know what, Tone? Screw your big tech guys. We're going to do it because we're Labour. I got a feeling that they're doing kind of slightly crazy things at the moment, this government, but not, I could be wrong. Yeah.
Not crazy. Well, the thing is, that's the front ending of it. They're going, oh, silly Starmer's done it again. But really, these are bills that were due from decades ago. What actually has happened is everyone stood up from the table. You know, Rishi Sunak's taken his plate of samosas and he's gone over to the private sector table. And he's left Keir Starmer sitting there and all these bills keep coming in. And they go, here, Keir Starmer, here's 30 years worth of defence neglect. Hope you can sort it overnight. And a lot of the Labour people go, oh, poor Keir Starmer, he's just being dumped on. Kind of have a point, but also it has nothing really to do with Keir Starmer. It has to do with 25 years of political mismanagement from the same sort of people doing the same sort of musical chairs. Once we accept that politics isn't, you know, politics isn't real, but I think honestly that is the great way to lead into your, I guess, post-politics era. And there's only so much that can be gleaned from politics. If you look at this with a political lens, you get nowhere. You start blaming Keir Starmer, who is squarely... there's a few people who are responsible for this, but Keir Starmer isn't really one of them. He's never really been in charge of this country's defence in a meaningful sense. People like to think, is he going to sit up there and man the cannons? If it comes to him, you know, with this hypothetical assistance to Ukraine, is he going to be on the front of a tank, you know, waving a sword? He's not, is he? He doesn't really know which way's which in terms of actual warfare. But we have this idea that he should be up there, you know, pulling the levers of power and making all the defence stuff work, when actually he's just sat there like a really... like, it's like somebody's got promoted. He really is. You know, people talk about Jen from accounts and all that. Jackie from HR, all the interchangeable female labor ministers. Keir Starmer's a bit like that. He's been promoted to the top job and he's just sat there like Arthur Daly going, oh my God. Oh my God, there's the defense bill. Oh God. I was supposed to sit in Downing Street and politely celebrate Hanukkah. You know, I'm not supposed to be dealing with this. I don't know. Oh, what do you mean that project started 30 years ago? Oh no. And there's a lot of that. There's a lot of like your weak kind of Labour ministers.
But
you know,
could he not, I mean, just to play devil's advocate a little bit, could he not? And again, I always think, what would have happened if Tone was there, right? If it was the Blair government, I mean, basically the choice it was, cut a pile of welfare stuff, let some people starve and increase defence spending, or not do that. And it seems like the government were like, do you know what? We can't really annoy our backbenchers too much, so let's just not do that. Whereas I feel like a more hardcore Liberal government would have just been like, sod it. I reckon Justin Trudeau would have done it, for example. But this government won't face down their left-wingers. But anyway, go on.
I don't actually think it's that. I honestly think the report is comically late. It looks like people are actually quite frustrated with Westminster because this isn't what was supposed to happen. This isn't 4DJs of any kind. Right. The defence spending review and the defence review itself, the strategic defence review, which came out in 2025, which itself was a bit late, was supposed to be the consent manufacturer for this 10%. The Labour government would love to do that, but they've asked the bureaucracy to write them all these documents and, you know, dot all the I's and cross the T's so that there won't be endless legal cases about this. Because you actually have to write legislation right in this country if you want it to work, which is what Tome was good at. Or you want to write these reviews right and you want to write spending plans and it all has to actually function. The office boys just haven't done the work is what it looks like. It quite honestly looks like the government's turned to these people and gone, come on, lads, we need some justification for this 10% that we're obviously going to have to do. And it's, you know, the justification writes itself. There's no reason for Keir Starmer not to. And, you know, they don't have to cut the welfare bill anyway. They can just print the money. I think they had all this teed up for them to print all the money for all this extra kind of, Ukraine and stuff. And Iran's happened and it's been a disaster. And they seem a little bit lost almost. There was a plan here. But things haven't quite gone to plan, but things are supposed to go to plan, and you didn't write the plan, and you were supposed to write the plan, and the plan's 9 months late now, it does seem to be quite a lot of that. I do think quite honestly that the government has become late with their own homework and is putting itself to bed early, but that's not helpful to anybody. Really.
Sure.
It doesn't really help anybody that people are going, oh, well, you were supposed to do it.
Right. Well, in a moment, we're going to get to the crux of what the actual issue is beyond this forgetting of homework and omni-shambles that is Westminster. But first, Grump, I need to remind people to buy courses at the Academic Agency. And you're going to be the first person in the entire world to see my brand new ad for something I'm calling the Ultra Bundle, which is basically all of the courses, every single one that I've done in one bundle. For one sweet price. So I'm going to play the ad. And when we come back, we're going to drill down into what exactly has gone wrong in the British defence establishment, industry, army, etc.
Ultra Bundle! Seven courses. Shakespeare! Research! Trivium!
That's your writing, your logic, your rhetoric.
Economics!
How do you work out the marginal productivity of a burger?
Politics!
Well, that's your theory of Moscow operator, except. The Ultra Bundle!
Buy it now!
Oh, there we are. There's a little bit of subliminal stuff in there because these ads get played so often that on your, like, your 17th run through, you'll be able to hear what, like, the seventh voice is saying in the background. But Scrump, you're on. You're muted, son.
Oh, there I am. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I was sneezing during the advert there. Terrible of me. You know, like in the 80s when they had, like, a rapper in the song but they weren't sure about it, so they'd mix him really low in an instrumental bit?
Yeah,
it felt like a feature that the producer was really unsure about.
Yeah, I like the idea of a mumbling. I actually liked that where back in the day it would be like Puff Daddy low in the mix.
Yeah, it'd be in the background.
It'd be IG, and it'd be like,
yeah,
in the background. Take that. So I wanted kind of non-committal background voice, but anyway.
It's a bit like Jedi mind tricks, a bit of the more, you know, you've got your "don't forget to remember your man" look at the background. it's that kind of stuff.
I tell you what else were good for it was the Fugees, you know. One tie, just the little background characters, the kind of Pras, Michelle and Wyclef when Lauryn Hill were doing their, was singing or whatever. But anyway, Scrump, let's get back to the UK defence industry. Okay, government forgot its homework, you know, office boys haven't done their stuff. But this is still like ephemeral, like this is still like, okay, so what? What's the bottom line? When we get beyond all the guff, what has actually gone wrong here in, you know, in the British military, in the British defence, et cetera, et cetera?
It's as simple as the government forgot that raising prices for everybody also raised prices for them. And a lot of their current spending plans have run out of control, whereas they thought they were going to spend a few billion. The big one's a nuclear one. The problem of the whole Trident missiles not working. There was that whole failed launch thing, and then the second failed launch and all that stuff. And it really is just, it's a lack of maintenance every year. It's them kicking five cans down the road every year. And sometimes it doesn't feel like a crisis, but within the military themselves, it's just been a complete lack of resources. You can run like a civil service a little bit like that. You can hollow it out a bit. You know, some bureaucracies are more resistant to the natural effect of kind of least output for most input. But the problem is that the military isn't. You actually have to deliver results at the end of it. And they're a crying baby in a basket of crying babies and have been for a very long time. And the MPs feel like they have to go around satisfying everybody. And really, it is political cowardice as well, that for the last 30 years, it's been easier to cut the military than cut the NHS. It's been easier to cut what could be considered ancillary and unglamorous programs and programs that were never going to be used, like nuclear deterrent, in favor of flashier vote buying. It's just the simple incentives over the course. I say 30 years. This is a problem that's gone on since Thatcher. People were talking about the shambolic nature of the UK military during the Falklands.
Well, I mean, last I saw, and this was a while back, I remember reading in the Telegraph, a massively reduced fleet. So the Navy, once the greatest Navy in the world, of course, is now a pale shadow of what it used to be, has very, you know, doesn't have that many vessels. As we saw with the various kayfabes over the Iran war, what vessels they do have, they're not necessarily ready, could take weeks for them to actually leave, if that was true. I mean, I'm guessing it was true at some level. So I know, I remember reading about that. I know that in terms of total manpower, the military is greatly reduced from what it was in Thatcher's time, or certainly from what it was in the 70s. And basically that's been the story across all of the armed forces, that we just have less stuff, fewer men. Some of the stuff that we do have is old and is getting costly to maintain as well.
There have been various extremely expensive plans to try and revitalize the military in the past. They just haven't worked. They've been part implemented. The real cost of them has come to the fore. And then the institutional cowardice has reared its head and people have gone, this is too painful. This is too difficult. And every time they, because exercising hard power, going out in the real world and doing things is difficult. It's more difficult than writing policy papers. And the government is staffed by people only really used to writing policy papers. So if you put the people who are in charge of writing the policy papers in charge of the tanks don't get made right.
So you're saying that they're, even the stuff they are funding, they're not doing it correctly.
Well, how... imagine you're some minor politician. You know, you're like Stephen Kinnock, you're Neil Kinnock's son. You know, you might, you're not the dimmest spoon in the drawer, but you don't know how to design, not only design and operationalize, but project manage and productize and manufacture at scale something like a main battle tank. You, that is actually gobbledygook to you. You're not somebody who's one of the very specialized set of people who could actually do that, but you're making the decisions associated with it. And you don't know whether or not you're screwing the pooch on that, because you get some technical feedback, but most of the technical feedback you get is from companies who are bidding. And a lot of it might just be, quite frankly, lies to make a large defense contractor a bit more profitable. And you don't have the technical acumen to differentiate that. And it's just that over and over and over and over again with people who run departments and allocate funding. They will often put large amounts of monies into programs that are, you know, Rodney Delboy Chancellor programs, basically. But they just aren't capable of telling the difference. They don't have the skill set. They are non-technical people making technical decisions, which creates a situation where their technical goal is either undeliverable in design, or they've entrusted it to people who have no hope of delivering it, or they've misunderstood the technical requirements entirely, which is usually what happens.
So one of the questions I would have here is, you know, you start from the premise that politics is not real and that the machine is going to run itself. Why would the machine let key decisions up to people like Stephen Kinnock? What's going on there?
Because they have to recruit inwardly. They're an elite. They are very cagey about going to outside people, as most closed groups who wield power are. They're very suspicious of people from private industry. They don't consider people who are outside of their political world capable of dealing with the political aspect of it. And so they mostly pick people from their own circles who they feel can deal best with the political aspects of their job, rather than the technical aspects of their job. And they just don't have a pool of technical people within their closed circle, within their closed world, to be able to make these decisions for them in a more productive manner. They literally lack the talent in their pool of what they would consider acceptable fellow elites, because the two have become quite mutually exclusive in many ways.
To what extent is this a British-centric problem versus a problem that's facing every Western country? I mean, one of the things I thought was interesting during the, so-called Iran War, the different iterations of it, is just how expensive the American equipment was, and just how inefficient it was. And, you know, the economics part of my brain was thinking, has that happened because the US defense industry has just become like a corrupt boondoggle, basically? We're just watching, you know, billions of dollars get spaffed up into the air because...
Oh, there you go. I'll send it to you in the little chat here. But there's a great example here from the America. I must say, we are actually more honest about it. One of the reasons we're able to have this conversation, one of the reasons there's even been resignations, is because this is actually quite an open process. Britain, we... All the things about Britain in which we're compelled to follow the rules do make their way up the tree. A lot of people do still feel like that. And so we are compelled, really, to describe, sometimes in torturous detail, the failings of the British state. It's just we describe them and never do anything about them. That's the trick. It feels like it's been dealt with because we've talked about it, but we haven't. We haven't dealt with it. We've just talked about it. But the Americans, the Sentinel program, which is supposed to be their big flagship, we can nuke you from anywhere, ICBMs, it hasn't even left the funding allocation stage yet. They are still wrangling about the bill to replace these missiles that need urgent replacing. And it's the same story. It is happening everywhere, as we saw in the Iran war with the French expending massive amounts of their missiles to counter extremely cheap Iranian drones. This is a NATO-wide problem, certainly. It's a global military problem. The Russians have suffered from some of this too. You mentioned the Navy. The reason that our Navy is not being redeveloped is that there is a lot of strong evidence that traditional World War II-style navies are hopelessly outmoded. The Black Sea Fleet was a big duck, famous to the US aircraft carriers, hot-footed around the Mediterranean, not really able to do very much. I had somebody who is inside the military, who does military analysis, describe them as big floating targets. I will not credit that person, though. But that is now how they are thought of, especially after the Iran encounter. So there's going to the problem was that the defense review has got a lot of what's referred to as seventh generational warfare in it. It's got a lot of we need drones, they're obsessed with hacking because that's cheap. Mm-hmm. And things like that. But really, this was supposed to be the we need to spend $1 billion on drones document. And they're just late. They're very late with it. But this has been going on for a long time. And there's this push and pull within the military of seasoned people who want to keep things going as they are. A lot of the alarm about the ship numbers, which is true. But there's also, there's supposed to be discussions about what type of ships that we have. Because we've seen people using things like drone carriers and things like that now. And basically remote control submarines, like hobby ones with like RPGs on them. Like, literally, it's almost like Looney Tunes. Because I remember being asked by somebody about why the defense industry is so expensive. Like, what couldn't you just like strap a cartoon bomb to a remote control car? And the defense industry's taken a long time, but they've realized that you actually just can strap a cartoon bomb to a remote control car. And so there's all these defense documents in the British military kind of background going, hey, guys, do you know that we could just strap a cartoon bomb to a remote control car? And everybody's going, oh, no, we have to have a whole development program. And then you have all the ridiculous things of, like, you know, North Korean arms flowing into Ukraine and all that, and cheap Chinese hobby drones with literal, like, hand grenades dangling from them being used and things like that. And the UK military defence industry, who's been charging, you know, the legendary kind of, it is a bit £50,000 for a pen up there, because they're used to it. They're used to the blank cheque. They're going a bit, oh dear, we're going to have to justify our existence a bit more. And so I think the politicians are hearing some of this too. I think they're saying, well, you know, Russia's throwing like toothpicks with Semtex on them at Ukraine and making us look like idiots. Why does everything cost $1 billion? Write it again. And it's that, but that process over and over and over and over, and then stuff gets delayed. And it's just this feedback loop of kicking the can for many, 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 many years. But it just affects all different aspects of it. And when you do get people enthusiastic about spending money, they just spend it in the wrong place. They wouldn't know how to spend it on defense. There's no feasible way they could.
Well, one of the things I was interested in, I made this video last week on China's plans for 2049. I know every time I talk about China, people go, you know, you get the Peter Zahan stuff, and you know China's really bankrupt and all the rest of it. One of the little facts I read out in that video was that China's navy is actually bigger than the American navy now in terms of total number of vessels. However, the Americans still can hold on to their cope of having the biggest navy by weight, by tonnage, right? But what that told me was that the Chinese have clearly had a look at the map and said, we don't really need these massive, like, old-fashioned destroyers and so on. What we want is, like, nimble, agile vehicles. And all of the stuff around the Strait of Hormuz and so on has really brought, I think, has brought this to bear. I think it's been, like, you know, all Trump stuff, oh, their navies are down at the bottom of the sea and so on. But it's like, well, the fact of the matter is they've got tons of these little, you know, on the actual ground, there's tons of these little vehicles there the Iranians have got. And I'm just wondering if the Chinese are already thinking, you know, 10, 15 years down the line, you know, this is going to be like, you're not going to want these World War II style old fashioned destroyers anymore. You know, it's like playing Civilization, and you've still got the ironclads in the space age or something like this. So, yeah, I mean, I guess the point I'm making is, like, if they can see that, and if I can see that, surely people in Westminster and in Washington can somebody somewhere must be saying, like, where we need to get rid of all of these old boats, all these old ships. Hence, that's why they're not buying any new ones, and they've let them kind of rot. Is that not
partially? Well, they've done the easy part. They've done the letting them rot part, but they haven't done the replacing them with something else part, because that's hard. So they've set all the ships to rot because they don't think they're worth anything anymore, but they're still arguing about funding the replacements for them. And that's what's going on everywhere. It's going on in America, it's going on here, it's going on in France, it's going on everywhere. The managerial class have gone, right, battleships, aircraft carriers, a bit World War II, we're going to have big drone swarms, right, guys? And they go, well, the paperwork isn't quite ready for the drone swarm yet, but have you tried this Israeli laser? Well, that doesn't really work very well. I don't know, we'll build a new tank, like the Ajax thing. Oh, no, that's rattling our troops to death. Why doesn't the new vehicle work? Why don't the nuclear missiles work? Why can't America make any of the interceptor missiles? And there's a lot of this going around. It's been like, well, we were supposed to be able to do this, but we can't. And they haven't. They're quite slow. The big bureaucratic ship, the military-industrial complex of America, is massive. It's huge. It's ridiculous. It's, you know, it's. I think it's like the world's biggest, most elaborate gun. But it's whether or not they can pull the trigger and it still works is a different matter. And that's kind of what they're dealing with. They've sat in the office and they pulled the levers of power, and things haven't happened that were supposed to happen. And it's genuinely confused some of them, I think.
Well, one of the other things that came out of the Iran war was that, you know, they had the ceasefire from April, and Iran was able to pretty rapidly bulk, you know, rearm essentially, because it manufactures a lot of its own stuff, and some of its stuff is quite cheap to make as well in terms of the drones, and, you know, but also some of the missiles they were able to replace. So they were kind of locked and ready to go again, whereas in the exact same time frame the Americans did not actually successfully replace all of the things that they lost because of this time lag. So my ultimate question here is, you know, given these difficulties that are being faced by the West, is there any prospect of the rest of the world, or the, you know, the would-be rising powers in the world, whether it's Russia, China, Iran, whoever else, North Korea, of at some point overtaking? I mean, in some technologies, in some tech trees, they're actually further ahead. You know, in hypersonic ballistics, they're meant to have better ones than the Americans have got. In certain other respects, China's meant to be ahead in, you know, these 10 different industries. I'm not a tech guy. I'm not a military guy. I just read this stuff. It could all be propaganda. So is there any chance of them taking over, or overtaking rather than taking over?
I think there's some chance of them becoming level. The big thing is that the idea that they're ahead is a bit of a misnomer. In fact, they're behind, and that's a good thing. A lot of the most successful military projects of Iran are derived from North Korean missiles from the 1970s that work. And they work, and you can make them. And that's what makes them a much more usable weapon than a lot of these. You know, the interceptor systems the Americans have are very good. They're extremely fancy. They're a lot more advanced than anything that Iran has. But they're also expensive, and you can't make many of them. They're a white elephant in a very, very true sense. The hypersonic thing is more that technology has existed for a long time, and its implementation. The West is still ahead technologically, quite considerably, I would say, but they've got lost in it. They've not understood which technologies to focus on. And one of the cutting edge technologies that Russia decided to focus on was hypersonic ICBMs, which have been theoretically possible for the British, the Americans, with their rocket tech to make for many decades, really. It's just expensive. And it's not really, it's like, well, do we really need faster nuclear missiles when we've got this big welfare bill? And the Soviet Union's not even there anymore. And that was the logic kind of post-90s, is that there's been neglect in the areas that you'd want to emphasize, and overemphasize emphasis in the areas that disappear off into fantasy, like hacking and multi-role, trying to the big thing the military's been doing that's cost them all the money is like the F-35 and the Ajax vehicle and all of these. They've been merging different pieces of equipment together in like a balance sheet exercise, and none of them work particularly well. They've been multi-rolling them. The Bradley, all of those. They've been multi-rolling the vehicles together in these extremely expensive amalgamation programs that are meant to save money, but create equipment that's mediocre in many roles and also incredibly expensive. And that's been their main material focus for the last, I'd say, 20 years, is this kind of engineering obsession with the multi-role, the Omnibomb, the Wonder Waffle, as it were. And also the Wonder Waffle that's cheaper and easier for the balance sheet, because if we only make one aircraft, that's more simple. And it is this thinking. That's where a lot of that energy lies, is in chasing their own tail. They do it with exceptionally good technology. It's really, really good tail chasing. It's really clever. They chase their tail incredibly cleverly, but they're still doing it.
How would the Day of the Pillow, that is the shuffling off of the stage of the boomers, finally affect any of this? Because I have heard it murmured that a lot of technical expertise is still wrapped up with people who are aging or retiring, and that once these people have gone, there's a genuine question about who's going to be able to, like, you know, they talk about that, like the nuclear codes, but like the dude who can do it is 70 or whatever. Like, so how much does this, like, is this ultimately going to be a good thing or a bad thing when the boomers are gone from a technical point of view?
I don't know, if you're interested in raw technical ability, it'll be a disaster. A lot of skills will be lost, and a lot of skills that we didn't know existed will be lost. One of my favourite examples as an engineer is people who know things about pressure-bearing surfaces. Anything to do with pressure-bearing vessels is an arcane art to many engineers, and not many people are legally certified to do it. And most of the people I know who have any involvement in that kind of field are in their 70s. And that's even worse in America. Everything we see over here is... Because it's really the same standard practice. It's like the Ford Motor Company manufacturing method of government. We have a Ford product plant government in the same way America has a Ford product plant government, in the same way Italy has a Ford product. The franchises, they're Western liberal democracy franchises that are supposed to be good because they all function the same way. But they're all malfunctioning the same way, by the same token. And that's really what we're seeing. In terms of what you said about overtaking earlier as well, I don't think they will. And I don't think in the long term they'll want to. I don't think China's actually particularly interested in projecting power at the moment. That's expensive. And they've seen America's disastrous misadventures. And then, again, they're struggling with their own crisis. But we will, in Britain, as the boomers go, what we'll feel really is skill loss more than anything.
Mm. My point, I mean, this may have got lost, but my point in that China video and my point in general is that, look, it doesn't really matter what the Chinese mindset is or what the Chinese say they want to do. If they find themselves in a situation where they're on the hook for the global trade system, whether they like it or not, i.e. it's going to be Chinese security, let's say, or the Chinese Navy underwriting or underpinning global trades, okay, which if they take over as a hegemon would be the case, it is only then a matter of time before they are forced by necessity, by dint of being in that role, to start engaging in things like gunboat diplomacy. Very, very few, like, hegemons, or, you know, when it was the British, like, the British didn't set out to be like, right, we want to be in charge of, like, everything, okay? But it kind of fell to them by dint of being in that position. Then it fell to the Americans. It's never like, and then, because they're there, they then end up engaging in it. Do you know what I mean? So it almost doesn't matter if the Chinese want to do it or not. If they're in that position, they will be forced to do it, is what I'm saying.
But, yeah. I think they already guarantee a lot of trade for East Asia anyway. And I think they'll just look to their local region. I don't think there will be a global trade hegemon. I think China is interested enough in trading with Europe and the rest of the world to not require that, and to just make trade agreements in which you have actual different trade blocks. We don't have the multipolar world yet. It started to appear. The first crack, really noticeably, that, you know, that definitely was undeniable was the Iran war. But that's just a lot of people going around and going, oh, well, there isn't this American security umbrella, but do we really need it? Is China really going to go to war with Europe over trade? No. They're just desperate to trade more. I think people just misunderstand that the Chinese just want to sell more toasters. They genuinely do. And that's a lot of what their impulse is to emulate some of the Western prestige that they've seen from manufacturing base. And again, I don't think they'll be... I think they've been overhyped militarily, definitely. I don't think they can project power particularly well. They can certainly scare their neighbours a little bit. I think China's just sitting back. I think they realise that America trying to bring its military to bear and the managerial weight all collapsed in itself. I think if China tried to do that, China's military is much better as a threat than it is in reality. If they tried to bring that to bear, they'd come against the same problems that both the Soviet Union and America has, in that actually bringing a military that size to bear is borderline impossible, and you end up smushing bits of yourself internally. I just think there'll be a trading block with a big stick, and as a trading block with a big stick, they'll look out for their own interests. I think it genuinely will be a good thing. I don't think people should be scared of China. I think people should actually worry about China a little bit, because all the stuff about, oh, is China gonna, you know, it's like, yes, they'll get stronger as compared to the United States, but that's because the United States is currently at terminal velocity in decline. It's really, really quite grim what happened with Iran. Well, I don't think people have reckoned the consequences fully.
I just think, though, that somewhere, let's say in, you know, in 1712 or something, there would have been somebody being like, look, don't worry about the British. They just want to sell tea. They just want to sell iron. They just want to sell coal. Fast forward 200 years and, you know, just by dint of the fact they're doing all those things, they then start getting embroiled in basically everything. It's like, you understand what I'm saying? Nobody kind of sets out for the responsibility of that. They just kind of like, I mean, the British really did fall into having to now I have to care about, you know, how the Ottomans are positioning themselves vis-a-vis France and Russia and all these sorts of things. They didn't set out that way. They set out because they wanted to sell, you know, cigars from the New World and tea from India and whatever, spices or whatever else. But fast forward 100 years and they had to get involved in those things. And the Chinese, you know, they're starting to dip their toe in a bit, at the very least, to having to care about, for example, I don't know, like what's happening in the Sahel and what's happening in sub-Saharan Africa and what's happening, you know, they'd rather not, but they also have to at some level care about that stuff because it could affect the supply chain.
A lot of their forays into that have been a bit disastrous. The big thing with omnipresent decline is it's going to affect everybody, and everybody's going to have to turn inwards for a little while. Whether China can come out of this period of turning inwards it's going to face rather soon as a possible hegemon is debatable. We'd have to see another century, really. I don't think China is going to become a hegemon within this century. Certainly not. I think they're going to have to reckon with a whole bunch of structural problems they have that they share with the West. I think there's this idea that China is completely different than the West, but in putting on our clothes and emulating us and in becoming our global subcontractor, they've contracted all our diseases, really, economically, socially, politically. They have many of the same problems we do. They have the same mass hopelessness crisis in youth. They have the same demographic decline, but without the immigration. Managerialists seem to be debating whether or not which is the most poison pill there. We know which one is, but they internally don't seem to quite know which poison's worse, but it certainly is a poison. Maybe the 2100s will be the Chinese century, but I think they genuinely do need that level and that length of development to become that. And I don't really see the ingredients there, honestly. In many ways, I think they've peaked.
Interesting. Well, anything else you want to touch on before we wrap this up?
I'd just say that, like, if you run a business and you face price rises that make certain types of activity or offering certain types of product impossible, that's exactly what's happened to the UK defence industry and the army at large. They've been presented with a really brutal economic reality over the past 30 years, and especially over the past 10 years, of constantly rising prices and constantly steady budgets, which is what every organisation in Britain has faced. They are actually suffering from the problem of the dog grooming salon on the street, just to a far greater extent because they're far larger. And I think it's just a good example of if you have people in power who aren't diligent and don't keep their eyes on lots of the little things, you end up in a situation where you have a lot of extremely big things wrong. And it is as mundane and as simple as somebody failing to run a company properly is. It's just, again, things are so much bigger and the stakes are so much higher. It is just a large-scale version of that. It's if you feel this is mystifying, it really isn't. It's just people failing to run an organization effectively.
Is stuff more expensive because they're having to import it all?
Partially. It's honestly, a lot of it's just legislative burden and cost of materials. And the fact that if you print money, prices go up in a way that hurts you eventually. It's a negative economic cycle. Yes, more things are imported, but it's also just incredibly expensive to make things here. That's why things are imported. So if you make it here instead of importing it, it's still incredibly expensive. People wouldn't import things otherwise.
Good point. All right, Scrump, where can people find you?
I'm on the YouTubes, the Scrump Monkey YouTube channel. And yes, we have the Anti-Politics Substack, although we'll be updating that a bit more. I'm not going to be marketing it too aggressively because it hasn't fully been edited and stuff yet, but I've got another book coming out at some point. You can find us over at Whifflings with our Anti-Politics by book. But we mostly do sporadic streams over on YouTube, and we're trying to offer people physical representations of what's going on and what's going wrong in a way that transcends politics.
Great. Well, do check them out. I always check out your streams. I think they're very good. I'll once again recommend people buy the Ultra Bundle.
Yes, buy the Ultra Bundle. That was a great advert, courses, by the way.
On all the other courses, and I'll see you all soon. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.